dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to believe that a man who understands that war as well as any, and who is making, in his own way, an outsized contribution to the understanding of the rest of us about it, is our guest for, it's very, very gratifying to say, a full hour. His name is David Goldman. He is a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, the author of How Civilizations Die and, well, countless essays, notably at the Asian Times, often under his pseudonym Spengler, but he is published elsewhere as well. And he's very generous with his time with us, for which I'm very, very grateful, and especially the chance to have an extended conversation with him. Luxury we don't often get to enjoy, but this will be very special, very important, very timely, as one of the things that David has just written about is China's plan for global supremacy and his inside view of what that is involving. David Goldman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. And again, thank you for making yourself available for an extended conversation. It's a great opportunity to visit with you.
Frank, it's an honor and privilege to spend time with you. Thanks so much for the kind invitation.
Good. Well, let's make the most of it. So in the tablet, you have just written about your insights inside China's plan for global supremacy. And the subtitle's very interesting as well. How the fight for the next communications ecosystem could make a world dependent on Chinese technology, Chinese software, Chinese e-commerce, Chinese venture capital, and the Chinese market. In short, on communist China. David, tell us what you think are the prospects for such a dependency and the implications.
Well, one of the scariest things happening from an American standpoint, Frank, is that in our own hemisphere, indeed on our own border, China is not only building the next generation of mobile broadband systems, but Chinese companies are supplying the venture capital and the expertise for the next generation of electronic commerce, electronic finance, and all the ancillary businesses that are made possible by the broadband. The Chinese behemoth Huawei, which has been much in the news lately, has for the last 8 or 9 years talked about this as the ecosystem, which will be made possible by broadband, but will allow China to turn the economies involving billions of people into little models of China. If you remember Che Guevara's famous slogan from the 60s, 2-3 many Vietnams, what China is looking for is 2-3 many Chinas. Think of it as the Sino-forming of the global South. And it means the economic and strategic encirclement, ultimately, of the United States.
And unfortunately, encirclement is only part of it, isn't it, David? The plan, actually, as Huawei is actively implementing it, seems to be inside the United States as well, providing at the minimum some technologies that, well, not only private sector entities, but even the government have in recent years been relying upon. That seems to have become problematic, at least on the government side of late, because of the reasons that you've been discussing. But what talk a little bit about what the Chinese envision in terms of the penetration of our own country with such technologies and the dependencies that flow from them.
The security in a modern microchip with millions of transistors is built into the chip itself. It's hardwired in. It's not something that you program after the fact. It's part of the hardware. All of the telecommunications hardware in the world now is manufactured in China, with very few exceptions. We've talked about using companies like Ericsson and Nokia from Scandinavia as competitors to Huawei for more security, but Huawei, like Nokia, like Ericsson, all manufacture their hardware in China, mostly in Shenzhen. So it's theoretically possible for the Chinese to embed backdoors in the hardware that Huawei's competitors are buying. Because the problem, Frank, is that we don't make any telecommunications hardware in the United States anymore to speak of, tiny amounts of it. And the only way to get control of security, ultimately, is to make it under secure conditions in our own country. And that is something which would be, frankly, enormously expensive. It would be disruptive because American companies from Cisco to IBM to, you know, Google and Facebook have all Intel. Well, Intel still makes some chips in the U.S., but increasingly it's being moved overseas. It's much cheaper to buy your hardware from China or Taiwan or South Korea, and as opposed to making it in the United States, and just do the programming in the United States. So we've had a huge boom in the value of tech stocks combined with complete gutting of our capacity to make the hardware. That gives us a vulnerability which can't be remedied except by a main effort to bring the industries back on shore.
Yeah. And there's so much to tease out of that, and we'll have to do so in part after the break. But just for starters, David Goldman, the idea that we could put ourselves in a position where our supply chains for all of these kinds of technologies, and I think what you've said about the telecommunications sector is pretty much representative of others as well, but the national security risks associated with such dependencies is as powerful an argument, it seems to me, as any for not having done it. But yet, and I guess this speaks to something I've talked with you about in the past, I think, the lack of national security mindedness by an awful lot of people in this country, both in the business sector and in the government as well, incredibly, that has given rise to this kind of outsourcing, if you will, of the technologies upon which we rely for both our commercial prosperity as well as our national defense.
I couldn't agree with you more, Frank. If you are the chairman of Boeing or Lockheed or Intel or any major U.S. company, your job ultimately is to worry about value for your shareholders and perhaps ancillary conditions of work for people who work for you. Your first job is not national security. That should be the job of the government. Our corporations have followed a path of least resistance towards making themselves more profitable. The Asians subsidize all of their heavy capital-intensive industry, which means it's always going to be cheaper to outsource your hardware in Asia. That's not just China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan as well. China's just so much bigger than the rest of them that they become a dominant force. And of course, they're a much more dangerous potential adversary than the others.
We have to pick up with a longer answer on the other side of a short break. We'll be discussing industrial policy, among other things, as a response to this kind of problem with David Goldman right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back visiting for this full hour with David Goldman, a man who knows his way around, well, the financial sector for sure, and economics. Indeed, he is a Renaissance man in every sense of the word. The author of How Civilizations Die. Also, under his nom de plume, Spengler, the author of, countless extraordinarily important essays and screeds and the like at Asia Times. One of your screeds, if I can use that in the best sense of the word, David Goldman, highlighted a problem that I know is very much top of mind, and based on what you said in the previous section of this show, is something that should be on all of our minds, which is the asymmetry that has developed between the procedures and policies and attitudes of those of us, particularly here in the United States. My friend and our colleague, Kevin Freeman, often says what we think of as a marketplace, our enemies think of as the battle space. We've been looking at just going with the lowest bidder. As you say, the economies of scale and the low cost of labor and so on has driven much of our business, manufacturing, particularly offshore. The Chinese have taken advantage of this in part because of their capacity for industrial policy. I'd like to ask you about how, if you think it's the case, we could possibly go about having one in this country, assuming that's what's needed here.
Frank, I'm a free market guy. Industrial policy always has the disadvantage when you give investment decisions worth billions of dollars to bureaucrats making $100,000 a year or more or less. The capacity for corruption is always enormous. It's not my favorite way of doing things.
Corruption and just plain old-fashioned incompetence. Isn't that an issue too? Mistakes made picking winners and losers, as they say?
Absolutely. But the problem is, when you're dealing with a continent, with a country of 1.4 billion people, namely China, with a periphery bringing the population up to a couple of billion dollars of highly productive, intelligent people, and they're running an industrial policy, then you can't avoid the problem. Because if you can't manufacture your own silicon, your own information processing, which is going to embed artificial intelligence and other smart weapon systems, you can't win a war. And the idea of having to win a war with components made by prospective adversaries or countries that might not be adversaries but are very squishy about standing with you, like South Korea, that's not a very good formula for military survival. So we need some kind of top-down approach. The question is, what's the best way to do it? Now, you and I, you in a much more distinguished position, of course, saw what happened during the 1980s when the United States beat Russia in the Cold War. We spent vast amounts of money through the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which invented the internet, but it also invented the laser. It invented fast, modern, light chip processing, all the key technologies that made the digital age and coincidentally won the Cold War came out of research projects which were done as a joint venture between the Defense Department or NASA and corporate laboratories. Now, the big companies were not necessarily the beneficiaries of these things because smart engineers who developed new products with Defense Department grants would start their own companies and quit. That's how Intel came into being. That's how most of our tech companies came into being. So, today's big defense contractors, the Boeings and the Lockheeds, are not necessarily the best friends of their innovation. They make their most money by selling us a weapon system and then selling us the same thing again and again for years. Disruptive new innovations benefit entrepreneurs, not necessarily big corporate America. So I think we need the old kind of tech driver that we had under the Reagan administration when we spent nearly 1.5% of GDP on hard R&D. I'm not talking about climate change research or bells and whistles in the F-35, but really transformative R&D. And we may need here and there some subsidies for some industries to get them back on shore. Now, I want to have as light a hand as possible in the allocation of capital. I think risk-taking is best done by the private sector, but we absolutely need the science driver, and we also need a change in educational policy. You remember when Sputnik went up in 1957, that was a wake-up call, and the Eisenhower administration put together a massive program for science and engineering education. We created a whole generation.
National Security Education Act, actually, is what it was called, as a catalyst for just that kind of work.
No, absolutely. Our biggest problem long term is that one-third of all undergraduates in China study engineering, and in the U.S. it's one out of 15. we're going to have to put our thumb on the scale very heavily when it comes to student loans and other subsidies to favor science education. And you know, there are plenty of programs the universities, in my view, could lose without harming the culture of the United States, all these resentment studies programs, as I call them. So there's a whole list of obvious things to do. And I say they're obvious, Frank, because we did them before and they worked before.
Right. But David, and I'm not being a contrarian here, I very much agree with you, but it does come back to what we were discussing a moment ago, and that is you have to perceive a threat. You have to acknowledge that, well, you put it, I think, rather boldly, the military survival of the nation is on the line. I think you could similarly say the economic survival of the nation, you know, the taking the whole enterprise together, the nation itself is in jeopardy on the way we're doing things at the moment. And let me just tease out a couple of things that you said here. The National Security Education Act of the 1950s involved not simply spending on the defense industrial sector, or for that matter, just on education. I think it was a much bigger level of awareness that had to be, you know, developed and informed, language training, as well as, you know, deep study of the Soviet system and, you know, Communist Party doctrine and all of that stuff. This is almost entirely absent, as best I can tell. If anything, we've been having Chinese-owned and operated Confucius Institutes providing such education as we have about China on most American campuses, at least until recently. David, talk about the Confucius Institutes, their mission, and the kind of impact that they have if indeed they're able to determine not only the pedagogy, but even the instructors of that pedagogy with respect to the threat, for heaven's sakes, namely China.
Like most governments, the Chinese government spends money in public relations, and they try to present a favorable, benign image of China's intentions with respect to the United States. That's what the Confucius Institutes are. They're a government-sponsored organization. They do the same thing that many of the Arab countries do in sponsoring Middle East Studies Institutes, which is one of the reasons you find that universities are overwhelmingly staffed when it comes to Middle East studies by people who are apologists for some of the most onerous practices and politics in the Arab or Persian world.
Yeah, if not practitioners of those that sort of ideology, I call it Sharia supremacism themselves, right?
The Chinese are very different from the Russians. You and I are old enough to remember Nikita Khrushchev taking off his shoe at the United States Nations and banging it on a desk. He came to the United States, Premier Khrushchev, and said, "We will bury you." The Chinese don't wish to bury us. They simply wish to encircle us to the point that we can't breathe, we can't move, we become a fourth-rate power, and they neutralize us over a long period of time. The Chinese want to boil us like the proverbial frog. They don't have this messianic bent like the Russians did, where they feel they had to tell the world about their plans for world domination and summon the proletariat of the world to rise up to support them. Chinese don't really care about any culture outside their own. They're very inward looking. What they want is economic domination. They want to control the hardware, software, logistics, transportation, ports, technology, robotics, everything that goes into the nervous system and sinews of economies around us.
Could I put this in a slightly different way and just make sure I understand you rightly, David Goldman? It seems to me, without contradicting again what you've just said, that the Chinese seek our submission. That it's a matter of sort of being vassal states or, you know, markets or whatever else they want us to be. But it will be what they want us to be and not an impediment to their ambitions, you know, far beyond our shores. But is that basically what you're getting at here? Because I wonder whether I'm confused by the statement that they don't care about, you know, so much us. It seems to me that relationship is what they do care about rather profoundly, isn't
it? Yes, the Russians had the ambition of creating communist parties which would take over governments and create a world dictatorship of the proletariat. What the Chinese want is an empire in which everyone else will be their dependencies and bow to them and pay them tribute and be unable to challenge them anywhere. I don't think the Chinese have the view that they'd like to create a political party which would ultimately take over the United States, which is what the Russians attempted to do with the American Communist Party.
But if it's effectively the same thing, that nothing is going to be done without their approval, effectively, whether it's under a communist czar or whether it's under, you know, business leaders who are deeply in the pockets of the Chinese, or for that matter, politicians who are. Maybe it doesn't matter so much, but the practical outcome is the same, is it not?
Well, it definitely would make us dependent on the Chinese economically. At some point, we wouldn't be able to borrow money overseas.
But it has political implications too. David, we have to pause. We'll be right back with much more with David Goldman right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are having an extraordinarily thought-provoking and timely conversation with David Goldman, a man we have the privilege of visiting with just about every week, a Renaissance man, as I say, who thinks deeply about, writes brilliantly concerning, and is really, well, I think of him as a national treasure when it comes to understanding some of the challenges we're facing at the moment, particularly from communist China. And David, we've, I think, sort of set the predicate here. There's a dramatic disconnect between the approach that the Chinese have been taking and the approach that we've been taking towards advancing our respective interests. Ours seems to have rather better served theirs than ours economically and in terms of financing and other means of achieving the kind of domination that they believe is their rightful due. We've talked a little bit about whether they are interested in controlling others as much as they are that controlling their own population. And I think where we've found agreement is that they are interested in controlling. It may be that they're a little less concerned about the exact nature of the control that they exercise as long as it achieves that result. But there is one thing that I wanted to introduce into this conversation because you've given, I know, a lot of thought to it in particular, and that is the advent under the Chinese industrial policy, if you will, their technology developments, their political system, of a kind of comprehensive surveillance state that I think George Orwell, on his worst day, couldn't have imagined. This so-called social credit score that the Chinese are now beginning to impose is worrying, I think, to those of us who hope that there might be a better future for the Chinese people. But as worrying is the fact that they're exporting it, and it may wind up in places that we care about, including perhaps even our own country. Talk us through that, if you would, David Goldman, please.
China knows what every citizen is doing every hour of the day, in a way, as you say, that Orwell with the telescreens in 1984 couldn't have imagined. They track everyone's cell phone in real time. They have, in major cities, high-definition cameras, by the way, with chips made by Huawei, which instantaneously recognize your face in real time. And now they're introducing so-called gait recognition. So even if you wore a realistic silicon mask, they'd be able to tell who you are from how you walk. And they cross-grid that information with every social media post you've made, every online purchase, every investment, every bank withdrawal. So with enormous amounts of computing power, they can tell what everyone's doing at all times and who's doing it with whom. So, for example, if you happen to be walking together with somebody who also made a social media post critical of the government, they immediately have identified a conspiracy against the Communist Party. If they don't like what you've done, they lower your social credit score. Now, what that means is that if you have a very low score, you're not allowed to board a train or an airplane. You're excluded from public transportation. And there are now nearly 20 million Chinese who are in that status, who can't even use public transportation, much less get a loan, much less get a job, and so forth. So the totalitarian character of this state, the all-encompassing surveillance capability, is like nothing anyone's ever imagined. It is really incredible. The Chinese Communist Party uses big data to identify prospective protests. So if you have discontent, the first thing they're likely to do is come in and throw some sops in, make some concessions, try to keep people happy. If that doesn't work, they'll put people in jail or they'll disappear them or whatever. So they've got a carrot and stick approach. The Communist Party tries to act as a benevolent dictatorship, and sometimes they do, but if they're pushed, they become unspeakably harsh. And from the standpoint of many other dictators around the world who are prospective allies of the Chinese, China can come in and say, buy our systems, become a little China, and you will be in power for life. No one can possibly overthrow you. And this is the evil side of the broadband ecosystem, because on one side, you have people who may have been sitting on a subsistence plot who suddenly have access to the world market. They've got a chance to be entrepreneurs. Their income will go up. I mean, China's per capita GDP in China in the last 40 years has gone up 35 times. It's like nothing. It's been an incredible increase in wealth. But the price you pay for that is by being hooked into broadband and living your whole life online. You're continuously monitored, and you give up any capacity to resist.
Yeah. And David, you mentioned, you know, some of the technologies involved here, but let's again lay those out. You have quantum computing, which means a capacity to process immense amount of data.
Yeah, you don't need quantum computing for this. The big fast computers they have now will do it fine. They already had this stuff up and operating when I visited Huawei headquarters 3 or 4 years ago. They had a map of the city of Luandong as an exhibition, about 4 meters by 4 meters on an enormous wall filled with millions of little blinking lights. Every one of them was a smartphone. They already knew where everyone in every city was at all times, and their computation could tell them with whom they were and what else they had done. So, you know, if somebody was going from point A to point B who'd said something critical about the government, they were already triggered to a prospective threat to the regime.
Yeah. You have artificial intelligence, which is helping to power this. You have 5G wireless telecommunications.
Yeah, already up and running in a couple places in China. 5G is already being rolled out at some railway stations, for example.
David, let's talk about the export of this technology and the kinds of surveillance state capabilities that it represents. Is this something that we're now seeing as a feature of the Chinese Belt and Road initiatives and the kinds of leverage that what I think of as payday loans, you know, the kind of debt trap mechanisms that are giving them such influence in many of the countries that are partnering with them? Are we starting to see this begin to manifest itself there too?
I haven't seen the Chinese build surveillance systems in large scale, but I think that will come. Right now, the Chinese are coming in a very benevolent way. You go to Huawei, which is an imperial, not a Chinese company. Half its engineers are Europeans. I know some people who work for them, very bright people. They've got right now the best technology and by far the cheapest, 40% less than competitors. So if you want to roll out a 5G system, you don't have much of a choice. The U.S. government made a big fuss about the Europeans and others buying Huawei systems, and the Europeans said, sorry, you're not making it in the United States, so what exactly are you trying to sell us? And that whole effort fizzled. It was, in fact, a real embarrassment because we don't have a competing product.
Let me ask you about another sort of technology sphere in which a similar kind of access to and use of foreign expertise is now getting some attention, David Goldman, and that is Google's support. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff last week said direct support to the Chinese government, Communist Party, military. The same company, which, lest we forget, has had its workforce say they won't work for the Pentagon. What's up with that?
I don't know how important Google's effort is to the Chinese. My guess is that their domestic companies can probably do all of that. I think Google is so desperate to get Chinese business, they're simply humiliating themselves before the Chinese and saying, we'll do anything you want us to if only you let us in. That's the impression I have. I think it's unseemly. And as you said, the fact that the management accepted a revolt by some of their engineers against working for the U.S. military is really past the limits of acceptable. People like that, people who refuse to work for U.S. national security should simply be fired by companies.
Yep. At the very least, there ought to be some costs to the companies of engaging in what seems to be treachery with respect to our national interests. And while you may be right, it's a little difficult to say how extensive the damage is that the Googles of the world are doing to our national interest in the service of the Chinese. But if they're willing to do anything, as you put it, to get into that market, one ought to be expecting the worst. Let me ask you about, coming back to the industrial policy point, let's just say for the purpose of discussion, and I think you have taught me this, that quantum computing and artificial intelligence and 5G technology and, you know, the data mining capabilities that these sorts of technologies make possible and the like are, you know, game-changing and likely to help determine who is the dominant power in the world. David Goldman, given where we are now, given the absence of an industrial policy, given the atrophying of much of our technology base, or certainly our manufacturing base, how does this work exactly? How do you envision going back to this sort of Reagan playbook? He had a lot to work with. It may have been starved for funds under Jimmy Carter, but you know, basically it was like a plant that you could add water to. It sprang back to life, as opposed to one that's been pretty much pulled up by the roots. What are you recommending?
Well, that's the bell and the cap problem. You're exactly right. Harold Brown, who died only recently, who was Jimmy Carter's defense secretary, was sort of a liberal on some issues, but in terms of technology, he did a brilliant job. Many of the technologies we used to intimidate the Russians in the 1980s were started in development by the Carter Defense Department. Back then, we had corporate laboratories. We had Bell Labs, where people won Nobel Prizes. Also, GE Labs, RCA Labs, Hughes, IBM. Every major corporation in the tech field had a serious laboratory with scientists and engineers working cheek by jowl with production people. So we were able to develop and put into the field technologies in a very short period of time.
David, hold this thought. We've got to take one last break. We'll be right back with David Goldman right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of this hour-long conversation with David Goldman, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom, but a man who's generously given us of his time for a full, in-depth, hour-long conversation on China and what it means that it is moving inexorably to a position that seeks to dominate the world, including ourselves. And just for, you know, sort of calibration purposes, that may seem like an exaggeration, David, but knowing the Chinese as you do, even before Xi Jinping came to power, this idea that China's rightful place in the world was the Middle Kingdom, the center of the universe, the dominant power in the world, indeed for most of recorded history, it was. We now have Xi Jinping, who has his China dream, as he calls it, who is all about achieving that historic place. What else should we know about the determination of the Chinese government and Communist Party that runs it that should inform this question that you asked us before the break about what we should be doing to counter it?
You know, my friend Mike Anton likes to write about the administrative state, the unelected bureaucrats who actually run the United States government. China is the ultimate administrative state. They've got a meritocracy picked out of the top 0.1% of exam scores who become leaders of the Communist Party. It's a dynasty of Mandarin bureaucrats as opposed to a biological family as the head of a dynasty, which I think will last for a very long time. And the ambition of the people who run China is limitless. As you said, I mean, China was the leading industrial power in the world until the 19th century. And the Chinese view is that the Western dominance in the industrial world is a momentary aberration in the long sweep of history.
A rough patch.
The center of humiliation was a rough patch for China. And when I was last in Beijing late last year, a number of advisors to the government said, we've taken some flack from the Trump administration for this Made in China 2025 policy. That was a dumb idea. That's just internal marketing. Our real target is 2035. I said, well, what's special about 2035? I said, just do the numbers. Put the lines in a graph. By 2035, we'll be the biggest economy in the world. We'll be so large, nobody can push us around. We'll dominate everything. So all we have to do is quietly build things up until then. And in the meantime, why do we want to get into a tussle with the United States when we know that by default we'll be unchallengeable in 20 years?
So this brings us back to the question you were addressing before the break. And just to summarize, if you can, David, if we take a page out of the Reagan playbook and we bend every effort through our educational system, through industrial policy, through targeted technology development efforts, and waging economic warfare back at the Chinese, can we get there from here at this point, do you think?
Well, you know, I think we can. You and I remember that back in 1980, all the smart money thought America would lose the Cold War. People thought we were cooked. It took a B-movie actor no one expected to become president to turn all that around. What I would really like, Frank, is to hear President Trump go to Rice University, where President Kennedy in 1961 made his famous moonshot speech, and say, let me tell you what it means to make America great again. That's when we went to the moon. That's when we beat Hitler. That's when we beat Russia in the Cold War. And call on America to use all of its moral and intellectual and physical energy to do something great and noble and important, which challenges our young people to do their best and to make the greatest contribution. I think if the president gave that kind of message, Americans would respond.
Well, I'd like to think so. He has been so vilified by so many people. I'm not sure that it would move, especially in the younger cohort, people the way we need them to be. But it's certainly worth a try. And I think the setting is, as you say, David, apt. And I hope from our lips to God's ears, as they say, or at least to Donald Trump's. Just one further question on that thought, David, as you're watching this drama playing out, of course, it's against the backdrop of, we're told, an impending trade deal. And I have to say, I'm not sure what to make of the trade deal or even the rumors of a trade deal as to what is actually coming out and how satisfactory it will be with respect to the specific things that it's supposed to be addressing, i.e., you know, trade practices and technology theft and protection of intellectual property and so on. But one thing seems clear, and that is that there will be a whole bunch of things that won't be addressed by that trade deal that are also very ominous about what the Chinese are doing. And the question will be, will we be told, the trade deal, we've solved the problem with China? What do you think about that prospect, and how do we counter it?
In fact, I'm very worried about it. What worries me the most is not the technology which China stole in the past. It's the technology which China may be developing now. Huawei has twice the R&D budget of its competitors combined. They're spending $20 billion a year, more than Microsoft. Half their engineers are foreign. It's not simply Chinese. It's a global company putting vast amounts of effort into new technologies. And by all accounts, their 5G hardware and software systems are better than anyone else's. It's the first time since gunpowder that the Chinese have led the development of a disruptive technology. So even if we were to, caulk up every hole where intellectual property is leaked to the Chinese, we'd still have the problem that they're developing some of their own, which we're not developing. So I think the key issue is to leapfrog them in technology. We're much better at innovating than they are. Not that they can't innovate, but if we put our minds to it, we can do it better. And that's outside the whole scope of discussion of the trade deal. That's what worries me.
Okay. Well, this is a subject to which we will return with you in the weeks ahead. I know. Let me lastly just ask you to turn to another part of the world in which you also have considerable expertise, David Goldman, and that is the Middle East. The president has made it clear that he intends to fashion and succeed where everyone else has failed in getting a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. He's set his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to the task, and I gather he's now sort of beginning to take soundings about what they've come up with in terms of a plan. There are elections taking place in Israel, of course. Bibi Netanyahu, the longtime prime minister, is in some jeopardy, we're told. Give us a sense of the lay of the land in this regard, if you would.
Well, obviously, getting a peace deal is extremely difficult, but President Trump has vastly increased the prospects by making it clear to the Arab side they can't win by playing games. As long as you pretend that the demand of the so-called Palestinian refugee, the great-grandchildren of people who left in 1948, have a right to return in Israel, you're saying that you're squishy about the existence of the state of Israel. And the Arab side will tell its own people, you see, even Israel's friends are squishy about supporting the existence of the state of Israel. So why don't we continue to go for broke and try to destroy the state of Israel? Trump, by saying we're recognizing Jerusalem as a capital, we're going to support Israel's right to annex the Golan Heights,
which he has just done, apparently.
He just tweeted this. God bless him for that. He's basically told the Arabs, Israel's there forever. It's never going to go away, and we're not going to play stupid games about, you know, rights of return and other things that would threaten the existence of the state of Israel. That's simply off the table. The president's explained this very clearly. So the Arabs say, okay, Israel's going to be there forever. We might as well find somebody to negotiate with them. So Israel's relations with the Sunni Arab, with Egypt, with Saudi Arabia, with the Gulf states, are now better than they ever have been before. And that puts a great deal of pressure on this little gang of crooks around Muqtada Abbas, the now in the 14th year of a five-year term or whatever it is, to try to make a deal or become irrelevant. So I'm not predicting a deal, but the president's done exactly the right thing to iterate towards a peace agreement, and I give him huge credit for that.
Yeah. Well, look, the ambition can be something that we credit him with. The prospect of essentially dividing Judea and Samaria, if you will, or the West Bank, and providing the Palestinians with immense amounts of money, assuming they would accept all that, and that is a big assumption, it seems to me is a bit fraught. So we'll be talking about that more with you and others, David, in the days ahead. But I thank you very much again for the time. This wonderful hour has flown by for me, and I imagine for our audience as well. It is always riveting to talk with you, and we'll look forward to doing so again in the near future. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.